from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in December of 2000, nearly 20 years ago, when the United States Supreme Court reached a decision on Bush v. Gore, the legal battle that was probably going to decide that presidency. Two decades on, you probably remember a few themes of that legal battle. Hanging chads, of course, voter intent, equal protection, different standards for different counties. On Twitter, here's what you're telling me. Brooks Brothers riot. Judicial activism. Hanging chads. And Matthias says, I was too young, thank goodness. Well, ultimately, the court decided not to allow a full statewide recount that the Gore campaign had been seeking. The former vice president was disappointed, but ultimately accepted the court's decision and supported the transition of power that would place George W. Bush in the White House. Legal scholars still debate the merits of each side in that pivotal case. 20 years later, we don't have hanging chads to worry about, but during this pandemic, we certainly have challenges. Vulnerable and elderly voters are justifiably concerned about waiting in long lines and voting indoors in person. But different states have different rules about voting by mail. There is no national standard. Some states simply want the ballots postmarked by Election Day. Wisconsin, for example, wants all ballots received by Election Day. And these decisions are coming just days before the election. This hour, we welcome an attorney who worked on Bush v. Gore to give us a legal perspective, both of that historic case and the questions that could arise in a close election 20 years later. Jeffrey Wadsworth is a partner with Harder, Seacrest & Emery. Jeff, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much, Evan. It's good to be with you.
What do people say to you when you meet them at a party and you say, yeah, I worked on Bush v. Gore? Do they say, hanging chads?
Well, you know, fortunately, I don't bring it up all that often.
Yeah, you're smart.
It's fun to be with you today and have a chance to talk about it. It's amazing. It's been 20 years.
So tell us what your career was like at the time and how you got involved. You worked on the Bush side of things. Go ahead and tell us about how you got involved.
Yeah, sure. So I graduated law school in 1999. I spent a year after law school working for a judge, and then I joined a law firm called Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher in October of 2000. When the election happened on November 7th of the year 2000, I had been at Gibson, Dunn for about a month, and Gibson, Dunn ultimately was retained by the Bush-Cheney team to sort of lead its litigation strategy, especially its appellate and Supreme Court litigation strategy. And so from really November 8th through mid-December, I worked almost exclusively on the Bush v. Gore litigation election dispute issues. And it was a whirlwind, to say the least. It was pretty exciting. I was very sleep deprived and spent a lot of hours at my desk doing different legal research and writing and conferring with colleagues about sort of the arguments that we were making.
How big was at least the Bush team? I'm not sure how much you know about the Gore team. One of our listeners says they remember that David Boies wore sneakers and a bow tie in court.
Right.
So there were some interesting characters. How big were the teams of attorneys?
Yeah, so I mean, there were literally dozens and dozens of lawyers on both sides who were involved to some degree or another. At our firm, we had maybe, I don't know, I'm guessing it was about 20 attorneys who sort of touched the cases at some point over that 5-week period. And there was probably a core of about, 12 or so who were really involved almost all the time. And I was one of those sort of team members. But beyond our firm, there were, as you probably know and the listeners know, there were many other law firms involved and lots of attorneys either down in Florida or in other ways kind of assisting with the representations. And I know the same was true on the Gore side as well.
Yeah. And so give me a sense for what your daily work was like at the time, the kind of research you were doing, and did you have any aha moments?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, when I first started working on this, we were, one of the key things was, trying to determine what the legal rules were in play. So part of it was looking at, in this case, it was in the Florida election law, understanding the statutes, researching those provisions and the way they'd been interpreted. But then it also was important in that case to understand how federal law would apply as well. So, understanding and researching constitutional provisions, federal statutes that applied to the counting of or the selection of electors. And, you know, the research sort of consisted of looking at case law, you know, previous cases from either the Supreme Court or other courts that had interpreted similar situations, or at least as similar as we could find, and also looking at things like the legislative history around certain statutes. So in that case, for example, there were a number of statutes that had been enacted in the late 19th century. And so part of the research that I did, among others, was to look at the congressional record from that period of time and to understand what the legislators were debating and the reasons why they were enacting certain provisions into federal law. We also looked at, you know, Supreme Court cases from, again, literally from the 19th century that had dealt with, you know, somewhat similar issues. So the research was pretty wide-ranging and all-encompassing, and it started immediately. I mean, that was really the first task in any case, but certainly in that case, was to understand the rules of the road and try to determine what arguments you might have and what issues might come up. So that started right away.
One of the big questions was equal protection, and that's a term that obviously still applies and people will hear a lot, especially if things get tight or if things get contested. What does it mean?
Yeah, so in this context, it means that every person's vote counts the same. And it's the one person, one vote concept. The way that it played out in the Bush v. Gore litigation was, as you may remember and others may remember, there were kind of varying standards or approaches in counting ballots. So you might be in one precinct in the county and a ballot was being counted one way, and the same type of ballot in another precinct or county was being counted differently. And so what the Supreme Court was concerned about was that was inflating or deflating votes, people's votes, and treating them differently and disparately. So the concept is one that's well entrenched in constitutional law, and it's that, you know, each person's vote should be counted the same and should have equal impact. And I think, you know, one of the things that's, I think, often lost about the Bush v. Gore litigation, and I say this because, not just because, you know, I was on the Bush side, but there were actually seven justices who saw and confirmed that there was an equal protection problem that was happening there. So in addition to the five who ultimately determined that meant that the election basically had, there the recount had to stop, two other justices also agreed that there was an equal protection violation in that case. So it was pretty well established that what was happening there did violate that one person, one vote principle.
Yeah. So can you tell me if I'm doing okay as a student of history here? Because if I'm not, I want you to correct this. All right. When you look at, though, I think it was 61,000 votes, whatever was sort of in question about a recount, especially, but a statewide recount that the Gore campaign wanted. As I understand it, one of the concerns was that different counties had different standards for deciding what kind of votes would count, which sounds sort of wild, but I mean, back in the time, 20 years ago, of hanging chads, you might have, what, Jeff, a ballot that was sort of partially punched, or one that the chad was almost punched fully, but it was still hanging. It hadn't dropped. I mean, like,
right,
you know, and so if you were in Palm Beach County and you had 50% of the chad punched out, but it was still hanging on the paper, that county might decide that is not a vote. Whereas two counties over, they might decide, yes, that's enough. We're going to count that. And the argument was, you can't have all these different standards. It is not a fair way to do it. We can't recount this way. We got to stop it. Is that fair? Is that right?
You know, I mean, I think at a general level, that's right. What was, maybe take a step back. So the way that, I mean, these were really antiquated ballots. So these were what are known as punch card ballots. So the voter would go in to the ballot box. They would have a pointy stylus, and they were supposed to punch out the hole, basically, for next to the name that they were voting for. And, you know, the instructions were that, you know, you have to punch it out, and then that will register your vote. And the vote and the the ballots were then counted by machines, and the machines were set up in a way that they would look for whether it was punched out or not. And so, you know, that process happened. The machines tabulated the results. It was really close. And Vice President Gore asked at that time for a recount, and I think it was four counties in Florida. That's when ultimately they got into a hand counting or a manual recount, and individuals, people, started to look at the ballots, and they were discovering that, hey, you know, here's a ballot that wasn't counted. It was considered an undervote because it was cast, but it hadn't been actually counted by the machine, because the chad or the piece of paper that was supposed to be punched out was still hanging on, all right? So it hadn't dropped off, and the machine wouldn't have counted that vote. So, as you say, Evan, then there was this process that was sort of happening on the fly after the election, where there was debate about whether a hanging chad should be counted as a vote or not. Everyone knew that under the machine voting, it wouldn't have been. But now that we're going to look at them individually, there was some discretion or at least some question about whether that kind of a vote should be counted. There also were other examples of things. There was what was known as a dimpled chad or a indented vote. So someone might have put the stylus on the punch out part, but didn't punch it out at all. So there was literally no daylight between, you know, if you held it up, and you might remember, you know, these images of people who were trying to count the votes, holding it up to like the light to see if there was any light coming through. A dimpled chad wouldn't have shown any light, but there might have been an indentation. And so there was a question about whether that counted as a vote or not. Then there were sort of these other situations that were somewhere in between, where maybe a voter had punched out correctly, you know, three other holes for other offices, but when it got to the presidential race, they didn't punch it out, but they indented it. Well, does that show that they knew how to do it and they decided not to there, or did that show that they had meant to punch it out in that situation as well? So these were the kinds of things that were happening as the recount was going on, and there were variations, and it wasn't just county to county, but it was literally counter by counter or precinct by precinct.
The most ridiculous system I can possibly imagine, by the way. Did anybody else but Florida, or was this Florida's unique bit of lunacy?
You know, I don't know of any other state that, at least at that time, that was using that same type of
course. Of course it was Florida.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course it was Florida.
I mean, fortunately, no one uses it now. And we learned things. So Florida, I think, learned some lessons. I think the country did as well, about the importance of voting and how to try to streamline some things. And we still have a ways to go, I suspect.
And former Floridians, you can come at me all you want. My brother lives in Florida. He tells me all the time they've earned it. They've earned that. And it wasn't just this election. But here, so we're talking to Jeff Wadsworth, who's a partner with Harder Seacrest and Emory in Rochester, who worked on the Bush team on Bush v. Gore 2000. And listeners, if you've got questions or comments as we learn from that history, and then we pivot and kind of look ahead to what some of the questions may be if it's tight this time around, you can call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. It's 263 WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Jeff, did you think that some of the people who were involved in various ways, for example, a lot of listeners bringing up the role of Florida Secretary of State at the time, Catherine Harris, do you think she acted in good faith?
I have no reason not to think so. I mean, I never met her. I don't know her as a person. I have no reason to think that she wasn't acting in good faith, but obviously it's a politically charged case and moment in history, and I certainly can understand how some people might feel that way.
Al Gore gave a speech in which he talked about the pain of being that close and the disappointment a lot of people were feeling, but he also talked about patriotism over partisanship. What do you think that meant to the country?
I think it was critically important. I think that, honestly, regardless of who ultimately prevailed in that recount process and the litigation that followed, whether it was Governor Bush or Vice President Gore, the loser was gonna act appropriately. They were gonna accept the decision. I think it was really important that, you know, I think both sides proceeded that way, and it was understood that, you know, even when it went to the Supreme Court, that although one might disagree with the outcome, the Supreme Court's ruling is final, and that's an important institutional and constitutional concept and principle that we as Americans abide by. And so I thought it was, you know, it honestly wouldn't have occurred to me that Vice President Gore would have done anything differently than what he did. I think he acted in an appropriate way. And I'm confident that had it gone the other way, you know, Governor Bush at the time would have accepted the result as well.
Massively important, I think, for all parties involved and for the direction of the nation. And then you look 20 years later, and President Trump has said in recent months that if he wins, it's because he won fair and square, and if he loses, it's because it was rigged. What do you think that kind of rhetoric does to this process?
Yeah, I don't want to comment much on President Trump's specific statements in that regard, but, you know, I think that I do think it's important that candidates for elective office, whether it's president or, you know, school board or what have you, that they respect the process, that they, you know, that if litigation ensues in the aftermath of an election, that the candidates respect the authority of the courts. And that's not to say that, you know, you don't necessarily challenge what's happened. I mean, so, for example, if there were a ruling from a lower court that one of the sides disagreed with, it's certainly not inappropriate to try to elevate that challenge to the next level in the court system. But at some point, it reaches the end. And whether it's because the Supreme Court weighs in and decides it, or the Supreme Court decides not to weigh in and the lower court ruling is final, at that point, any candidate, whether it's, you know, at any level, should respect that authority. I mean, that's the way our constitutional system works, and it's worked that way for a long time, and we need it to continue to work that way.
I understand the notion of county by county having different rules during a possible recount and the concerns that might create. For the reasons and the scenarios that we've just talked about, that especially in the year 2000, if someone in Palm Beach County partially punched a Chad and they decided an individual manually recounting said, you know what, we're going to count that looks like the intention of the voter was to vote for Bush or Gore or Nader or whoever. And then the county over, that same standard, an individual conducting the manual recount said, you know what, here it's got to be fully punched, partial punches are not going to count. I understand why that's a problem or that's confusing and inconsistent. To apply that standard to the country, we have different rules everywhere from state to state. So, yes, in county to county, that was an issue within a state. Why is there not a national standard? Why aren't there equal protection issues every time there's a national election? Because the rules are different from state to state.
Yeah, and the reason is it's the way that our system has set up elections. So the election process is run by, in this situation, in the presidential election, it's run by each state. And actually, it's the state legislature that is charged under the Constitution with determining the manner in which electors are selected by each state. So in our Constitution, it's set up in a way that each state could do things differently. And then, you know, the election law, you know, for all federal offices, well, I guess at least for the president, and there might be a more federal involvement on selection of representatives and senators. But for president, it's that each state's going to figure it out for itself as charged by the legislature. And that's going to lead to some differences. So I certainly understand your point, Evan. I think it's a fair one, right? That why should someone's vote in Pennsylvania be treated differently than someone in New York? And I think the answer is simply that that's the way that our framers set up the way we're going to select these. And, you know, as long as that state applying the same standards across the state, or if it's a countywide office, you know, across the county, to make sure that the selection of that official is done in in an even way and that each person's vote is counted evenly, I think that avoids a lot of the problems. But for sure, you know, if we had a national standard like Great Britain or the UK, we, you know, things would be done a little bit differently.
Well, you know, we'd need fewer lawyers, Jeff. talking to Jeff Wadsworth, a partner with Harder, Seacrest and Emery, who worked on Bush v. Gore on the Bush team in 2000, and is talking about what we learned about that case, how the court decided and perhaps why the court decided the way it did, what equal protection means, and some of the possible questions that may come around 20 years later. 844-295-TALK if you've got questions. 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or you can email the program connections at WXXI.org. So as we look to what the court's been doing just this week, Jeff, my concern, and I made no secret, I've got a big bias, and my bias is my aging parents in Ohio, who are certainly immunocompromised, my mom in particular. I worry about them all the time, and I didn't want them voting in person. I don't want them in crowded rooms. I don't want them indoors with other people right now.
Sure.
That's just how I feel. And there's a lot of people who are very concerned about waiting in long lines, about voting indoors, about things getting crowded. So, I understand how difficult an election during a pandemic is. What I don't understand is why we are just now getting decisions on what's going to count 5 and 6 and 7 days before the election. We've had months now. Why are these decisions being made now?
Yeah, it's a good question, and there's not a good answer for it. I mean, as I mentioned a little bit ago, the election process is, it's in the hands of the state legislatures. So these rules or laws should be firmly entrenched long before, you know, the days leading up to the election. And this year obviously is a little bit different and presents unusual circumstances, to say the least. But I think in some states, at least, the legislatures were out in front of this, and they were enacting new, revisions to their laws to account for whether it was mail-in ballots or an extension of a deadline or that kind of thing. And in some other states, maybe the legislatures weren't out in front as much. What we're seeing now, I think, is that as the election approaches, the campaigns are focused on the rules, and they're trying, I think, you know, to understand, okay, well, do these rules mean what they say? And in certain states, the state courts have extended or changed or revised the laws that were passed by or enacted by the legislature. So the questions that are going up to the Supreme Court of the United States now come from these states where there has been, an effort by one or both of the campaigns to understand what the rules are, see if there is an extension of time to accept ballots, for example, and state Supreme Courts or state courts are deciding that there should be an allowance given or an extension or something that is different than what was written by the legislature. And those are the types of cases that are now you're seeing go up to the Supreme Court. And from what I've seen, at least so far, the Supreme Court has not taken any of those cases or upset the lower court rulings in any of those cases. But there definitely seems to be, you know, a few justices, at least, who are concerned about the prospect that, A, state courts are changing what the state legislatures have done, or B, that there could be a change in the rules after the election. So right now we're in the pre-election stage, and one of the issues that kind of came up in Bush v. Gore was, and one of our arguments on our side of the case was that you can't change the rules after the election. And so I think it's good that at least we're previewing those issues now, that the courts are considering things before the election. But what I'm kind of reading between the lines, it does look like the Supreme Court might be, or at least some justices might be worried that after the election happens, will there be some attempt by whichever side is a loser in a certain state to try to get a court decision that might change the rules after the election. And that's where there's real concern.
I want to explore that a little bit more because I would dispute the notion that we are pre-election. We are in the election right now.
Well, that's a good point.
Today, Jeff, today, this morning, marked a kind of a milestone. Right now, as of about 9 o'clock this morning, Eastern Standard Time, more Texans have voted in the presidential election in 2020 than voted in 2016.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
4 days away from the actual quote-unquote election day. So we are in the election. I mean, we're not pre-election. We are in the middle of it. I take the point that you got to be very careful about letting rules get decided when something has already started or when something might be over. That's why my concern was, why didn't we see every state settle this all by August and say, here's how it's going to be, everybody. Here's how, and our state's going to do a little differently. Pennsylvania will be a little different than Wisconsin. Montana might be different than Idaho, but we're going to let you know in advance and give you all of the options. When people find out when they're in the middle of it that, hey, if you don't get it postmarked by X, it might not count, even if you're getting postmarked before the election. But hey, if you lived in Pennsylvania, it would count. That is, to me, unacceptable in a pandemic, and that leads to a lot of frustration. I'm not saying it's corrupt. I'm saying that I thought better leadership would have said, this is all sorted out by August. But here we are.
Yeah, so, I agree with you completely.
Okay, fair enough. So here we are. And after we take our only break of the hour, we're going to come back. We've got some questions for listeners for Jeff Wadsworth, a partner with Harder, Seacrest, and Emery, who is a partner with that firm in Rochester, but 20 years ago worked on the Bush team in Bush v. Gore and has a lot of experience trying to understand what equal protection means in an election, how it applies. And not only what happened 20 years ago, but maybe at least giving us context to understand the questions that are coming up 20 years later. Let's take that break and more of your questions for him next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with the superintendent of the Rochester City School District, Dr. Leslie Meyer-Small, joined by Adam Urbanski, the president of the Rochester Teachers Association. The Teachers Association surveyed their own members and found that 81% of teachers said they wanted to stay full remote next quarter at least. And RCSD is mostly going that direction, staying full remote. We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me read some listener emails. And as I do that, I hope that this sort of doesn't need to be said, but it sort of feels like it does. I know there's a lot of emotion and intensity with this election. Maybe more than most. And there's always a lot of emotion and intensity. I hope we can all agree that no matter what side you're on, you want your side to win, but you want your side to win not by legal maneuver or not by voter suppression, that you want to win because you want to find out that you had the most votes cast for your side. I know that Jeff Wadsworth has said he feels that way, and it's important. I really hope that everyone agrees with that, because the emails and the feedback indicate there are a lot of people who feel that 2000 got stolen from them. Here's Barry, who says, how about the tens of thousands of votes that were counted for Buchanan, which were meant for Gore? I think he means Bush. I don't know if this was Buchanan.
No, I think, yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. I mean, so there was the way that the ballot was set up in Florida, it was called a butterfly ballot.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was alphabetical, actually. Maybe it was. No, I guess not. But I think Bush was, at least on the sample ballots that I remember seeing just on the internet and years later, showed, I think Bush was at the top, and he was on the left side, and then over on the right side was Buchanan.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan, right.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan. And then below Bush on the left side was Gore, and it kind of alternated. There were a lot of people who were actually candidates for that office. And so there were votes for Buchanan that some believed were intended to be votes for Gore, because just the way the ballot was set up, it was a little bit confusing. And the other thing that happened, which were a little bit easier to sort of understand, were what was called overvotes. I talked a little bit about the undervotes earlier, but the overvotes were where a voter punched two different candidates for president. And so the question was, well, what does that mean? Should that be counted? And if so, which one should have received the vote? So I understand what the question's getting at. And I think a lot of people felt like the Buchanan votes were intended to go to Gore, but it was kind of a hard thing to determine.
David writes to us to say, you should bring up Ruth Bader Ginsburg's scathing dissent in the Bush v. Gore case. He writes, quote, Justice Ginsburg's dissent put her in an unusual position, arguing against an equal protection claim. She thought the court should have respected the principles of federalism and abided by the ruling of the Florida Supreme Court, letting the recount go forward unobstructed. Though Ginsburg does not say this, some commentators feared the majority's equal protection rationale was a ruse, a cover for a politically driven decision. The court's decision to use a sui generis ruling, only applying at the case at hand, only bolsters the claim that protecting the equal right to vote was not the court's primary motivation. That's from David. What do you make of that, Jeff?
You know, I guess the point that, and I made this at the outset, that I think is sometimes lost in that discussion was that Justices Souter and Breyer both held that there was an equal protection violation. So Justice Ginsburg and Justice Stevens were the only two justices out of the nine to say that there wasn't an equal protection problem. And I think even Justice Ginsburg in her dissent said, you know, she said something to the effect of she understands the issue. I mean, she didn't get into a lot about why it wasn't an equal protection problem. She sort of said, you know, I see the issue, but I don't think it rises to that level. And I think her overriding concern was that was the federalism issue. It was that a state court should be allowed to interpret its state election law. And I think most federalists would agree with that in a lot of circumstances, but in a federal election for president, because of the constitutional role and the federal statutes that were in play, it became a federal issue. The Constitution, again, I mean, as I talked about, it delegates the responsibility for choosing electors to the state legislatures and the way that they want to determine that.
Now, it does seem to me, Jeff, that 20 years later, that the Supreme Court so far has signaled a preference for letting legislatures decide the rules this year, not necessarily state courts. Do you agree with that?
I think that's been on the mind of some of the justices. So, you know, what's happened so far is that the Supreme Court has declined to take these cases, but occasionally, at least in some of them, one or two or three or four justices have written short decisions to explain their thinking as to why they agreed with not taking it or they disagreed and thought they should have taken the case. And in some of those writings, some of the justices are picking up on or kind of highlighting the issue that you just identified, which is that the legislature should decide the rules, not the state courts.
Well, so on that note, I want to talk a little bit about, let me actually get another listener question in because I think that'll help us segue into where I want to go next. Mark wants to know, did you work with Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, who were part of the Bush team?
I did not. So neither of those individuals were attorneys at Gibson Dunn where I worked. So I did not work with either of them.
Mark seems to have a discomfort with an attorney from the Bush team who's now in Bush v. Gore, who is now on the Supreme Court potentially deciding another similar case potentially. Do you have any discomfort with that?
You know, honestly, I don't. And let me explain maybe why. I mean, I think part of it is that, you know, there are justices on the court now who ruled on that case. So, I mean, to the extent someone's infected by the case, it would apply to others besides just those who might have worked on it. But as a kind of a larger principle, whatever the issue is that comes out of this election, if any ever does, it's going to be different. It's going to be a different issue. It's not going to be about the standardless, hanging chads and indented chads and that kind of thing. So I think any justice can fairly, on either side, could fairly judge, what's happening in a new case that presents maybe similar but different issues. And it happens all the time. I mean, every justice has had, you know, some legal background before they joined the bench. And they, you know, in Justice Ginsburg's case, for example, you know, she was involved with a lot of cases that were supported, you know, in her role at the ACLU and otherwise that, you know, were presented to her as a justice later on in some variation. And no one thought that she shouldn't sit on those cases. And I think a similar rule would apply here.
So I want to talk about then about some of what Justice Kavanaugh wrote this week, some of what Justice Kagan wrote. And I suspect Jeff will have a little bit more context or more to say than maybe the lay public in reading and trying to understand. But I'm going to read from the New York Times this week about the Wisconsin case. Quote, the Supreme Court decision on Monday, barring the counting of mail-in ballots in Wisconsin that arrive after Election Day, was not a surprise for many Democrats who had pressed for it but expected to lose. But a concurring opinion by Justice Brett Kavanaugh set off alarms among civil rights and Democratic Party lawyers who viewed it as giving public support to President Trump's arguments that any results counted after November 3rd could be riddled with fraudulent votes, an assertion that is unsupported by the history of elections in the United States. Now, let me read what Justice Kavanaugh, some of what he wrote. Again, now quoting the Times, in his opinion, attached to the 5-3 ruling against the deadline extension in Wisconsin, Justice Kavanaugh wrote that Election Day mail-in deadlines were devised, quote, to avoid the chaos and suspicions of impropriety that can ensue if thousands of absentee ballots flow in after Election Day and potentially flip the results of an election. He added, quote, those states also want to be able to definitively announce the results of the election on election night or as soon as possible thereafter, end quote. Justice Kavanaugh's statement mirrored in some ways Mr. Trump's efforts to suggest that only ballots counted by Election Day should decide the result, and more generally, to push unfounded claims about widespread voter fraud. Earlier on Monday, the president had posted on Twitter that election officials, quote, must have the final total on November 3rd, alleging without evidence that there are, quote, big problems with mail-in ballots. Mr. Kavanaugh's concurrence was met by a dissent from Justice Elena Kagan, who wrote, quote, there are no results to flip until all valid votes are counted. Nothing could be more suspicious or improper than refusing to tally votes once the clock strikes 12 on election night. To suggest otherwise, especially in these fractious times, is to disserve the electoral process, end quote. Jeff, I will tell you honestly, unless I'm missing something, and I'd love to know if I am, I have no idea what Justice Kavanaugh is talking about. Just because CNN says that Joe Biden is ahead in Pennsylvania or ahead in Wisconsin at 11:50 next Tuesday night doesn't mean that Joe Biden has to win that state. And if 2 days later they count all the ballots and it turns out Donald Trump won that state, then Trump won that state and vice versa. A television projection or a television count, an update of the count is not a result. And Justice Kavanaugh seems to think that what's on TV is a result, whereas what Justice Kagan is saying is, no, you count all the votes and then you've got a result. Am I missing something?
You know, I mean, it's hard to know what was in Justice Kavanaugh's mind when he wrote, you know, that sentence. But I think he certainly would understand that the TV networks don't, you know, that when a TV network declares an outcome in a state, that that's not an election result. I don't know what he was trying to get at there. I think from my understanding of that opinion that he wrote, he was talking about the issue that we've talked about, which is that the Pennsylvania legislature said that all ballots have to be in by 8 p.m., I believe, on Election Day to be counted. And then the state Supreme Court said, no, we're going to extend that by 3 more days. And I think his point was that you need to abide by what the legislature has said, and the state Supreme Court can't change it. But, you know, what he meant in that sentence or those sentences, it's hard to know. I can say with some confidence, I think he understands how the election process works.
Yeah, and I think the overall sentiment seems to be that when ballots come in after the election and the results end up sort of looking to be reversed, there can be a suspicion of corruption. But Justice Kagan is saying that doesn't mean there's actual corruption. If you want to allege corruption, you have to prove it. And all of these comments about mail-in votes being fraudulent, ballots arriving that are postmarked on Election Day but come in 2 days later are fraudulent. We just don't have evidence of that. And I don't know that we do have evidence that there's widespread fraud with mail-in ballots. Do you, Jeff?
I don't. I don't know of any evidence to suggest that. I think that, you know, I think people have some suspicions or questions about how the mail-in process works. And it's not something that a lot of people have done before. I actually have voted, you know, absentee when I was in college. And so I've kind of gone through a mail-in ballot process on my own and, you know, submitted the ballot and what have you. And I can't remember if I had to get it notarized or witnessed by another person and sent it in. So, I understand for those who haven't had that experience that there can be some questions about how this works. But I haven't seen any evidence that would suggest that mail-in ballots in and of themselves is, leads to fraudulent voting. But as you say, if that evidence comes out at some point and people think that there's a reason to say that there has been some type of shenanigans or something with mail-in ballots, then that'll come out at some point. But yeah, it hasn't come out yet that I know of.
Yeah, and I just want to mention to listeners as well that we'll, of course, will be on the air with you on election night. NPR will have national coverage. And I suspect the national election, the presidential election, is going to be closer than a lot of people think, tighter. I'm always wrong, by the way, so take everything with a massive grain of salt. I am always wrong on politics and sports. But if it is tight, you may see results from Texas that look one way on election night and change. You may see results from Pennsylvania especially. In fact, some really smart people that I follow in Pennsylvania politics have suggested that if the polls hold, and right now the average of polling in Pennsylvania is Biden plus 5, if that holds, then what we're likely to see on election night at 11:58 p.m. is Trump ahead by double digits in Pennsylvania. Consider that. Right now, based on what's going to come in Pennsylvania, the president is likely to be way up on election night in Pennsylvania, and it could take several days to get all the votes counted. And that might look like it flips. And if the president claims that's a result flipping, it may not be. There's not evidence that it would be. So I'm just urging you. And by the way, Texas may be the opposite. We could see Biden with a lead on election night. That could flip in several days. Just be patient. Please be patient. I hope everyone can be patient, knowing that on Tuesday night or even early Wednesday morning, we may not know, and that's going to have to be okay. And we're going to try our best to have a transparent process that is trustworthy, it protects people. I really do think that matters. Let me continue with a few listener questions. Andrew wants to ask, then what would your guest's biggest concern be about protecting the election this year?
I don't know that I have a concern about protecting the election.
Okay.
I mean, I think I didn't have a concern in 2000, right? I mean, it just sort of happened, what happened in Florida. It wasn't something anyone predicted in advance. I think now, perhaps in large part because of the Bush v. Gore litigation in 2000, campaigns are much more attuned to these things in advance, and that's why we're seeing some of these issues coming up now. But I don't have any particular concern at all about this election.
Okay. Nathan directs us to a piece in The Atlantic. He writes, Evan, there's talk of a Republican contingency plan as reported by The Atlantic. And then he quotes from The Atlantic, quote, according to sources in the Republican Party at the state and national levels, the Trump campaign is discussing contingency plans to bypass election results and appoint loyal electors in battleground states where Republicans hold a legislative majority. With a justification based on claims of rampant fraud, Trump would ask state legislators to set aside the popular vote in that state and exercise their power to choose a slate of electors directly. The longer Trump succeeds in keeping the vote count in doubt, the more pressure legislators will feel to act before the safe harbor deadline, which is December 8th. Nathan wants to know, what do you think about that, Jeff Wadsworth?
I don't know anything about that. The safe harbor deadline I know a little bit about, because that was the issue in our case in Bush v. Gore, was that there was a December 12th deadline for that safe harbor, and that was why the five justices of the Supreme Court said on December 12th in their opinion that time is run out. There's no more time to do a recount. And justices, Souter and Breyer disagreed. They thought that there was another 6 days, and they thought there would be more time. So that's what the safe harbor provision is generally about. And I didn't actually know it was December 8th this year, but that makes sense.
Okay. And Tim wants to know, is there a possibility that more than one case will be brought before the United States Supreme Court, depending on the legal questions posed?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, there won't be any case unless the election is really close and that in one or more of the determinative states that the margin of victory is really close, right? So, I mean, those are sort of, you got to have that first. then you need to have a legal error that's committed in a court below for the Supreme Court of the United States to decide to weigh in. And they have discretion. They don't have to take these cases. And I think, you know, as I've said, I mean, on the cases that have been up there so far this year, they've decided not to take them. And although certain justices have written their reasoning in that regard, the court hasn't yet agreed to take a case, and I'm not sure that it would.
I want to read a little bit of what David French wrote this week. Listeners, if you don't follow David's work, you really ought to. He's does just really interesting commentary. He's an author, he's an attorney, and he's a conservative. And this is what he wrote this week. Quote, "It is deeply disturbing that virtually everywhere the concerted litigation strategy of the GOP is to make sure that fewer votes count. The strategy goes far, far beyond any legitimate concern about fraud." End quote. That's from David French. And here's Damon Linker, who's a self-described centrist of the centrists, writing for The Week in response to what French wrote. Quote, "It is very clear that Republicans fight extremely hard to make sure fewer people can vote." End quote. Is that a generalization that you would agree with, Jeff Wadsworth?
I mean, it's not something that I really spend a lot of time thinking about. I can tell you that in 2000, the concern was that after the election, there was a lot of stuff that was happening that was chaotic and confusing and conflicting. And that led to you know, the case that I was involved with. I mean, at this point, you know, I think that there's, on both sides, there are the litigation that's ensued so far has been to try to get an understanding as to whether the legislative rules are going to stay in place or not. And that, you know, so beyond that, I really can't really comment on what David French was saying there.
Okay. Do you think Americans have the sufficient access to voting safely, especially this year? Are you pretty comfortable and confident with that?
Yeah, I can't speak to every state. I don't know, you know, how it's working. I can tell you, you know, in New York, obviously, I think people have an ability to, you know, to vote absentee if they want to through a mail-in process. There's early voting this year. So I think that the efforts have been made within the state to make sure that people have an ability to vote safely and have their vote counted. And that's important.
And Alex wants us to stress before the end of the hour what federalism means. He says when it comes to the power of the states, let's make sure we understand that powers not enumerated are relegated to the states. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jeff?
Yeah, a little. I mean, so I think what he's referring to is the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights reserves all powers not enumerated in the Constitution to the federal government, reserves those powers to the states. And so that's part of what federalism is about. I mean, what in our system, you know, the federal government has sort of supreme authority in their sphere as to laws that they pass and that those control across all states. But then there's a lot of areas where the states are the arbiters of their own rules and laws. And so, and you know, people talk about from time to time the laboratories of the states. Mm-hmm. There can be different ways to do things. And I think we've seen that in this pandemic. You know, different states are applying different approaches to the way that they're dealing with this. And some would say, you know, some states are doing better than others in that regard. And that's sort of the laboratory process. In other instances, which are, you know, less life and death, you know, that process plays out in other areas across the different states. So, I mean, but I think what he's referring to is the 10th Amendment, and that the things that aren't within the sphere of the federal government are expressly reserved for the states to figure out how to do.
And that's why we're going to see different rules in different places this year. So Listeners, get used to that. In our last minute here, Jeff, I've asked listeners what their first thoughts are when they think Bush v. Gore. A lot of people say hanging chads. Some have said Brooks Brothers riot. Some have said Gore's classy concession. There's a long list. What about you? When you think back 20 years ago, what's the image that comes to mind first for you?
Yeah, you know, for me, it's more my individual experience, which was, it was just exhilarating. I mean, I think I was a young lawyer. I was in the, you know, I was in this this maelstrom of turmoil, but interesting, extraordinary legal issues and things that were happening. So I was living, obviously, well, maybe I didn't say this, but I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time. And I remember, you know, I'd ride the metro. So I was working, you know, it was dark when I'd wake up and it was dark when I, you know, when I'd go home and was working long hours. And I remember riding the metro and looking around and seeing everybody on the whole metro with their Washington Post up. And I knew that, you know, it hit me one day that, yeah, they're reading about the thing that I'm going to work to work on. And that was really exciting. It was, it was an intense period of work, but it was something I look back on fondly. It was quite a time.
Well, you've helped set the stage with the kinds of issues people are going to need to be looking at. Though I think I hope. I mean, I love lawyers. My father's a lawyer, Jeff. I hope we don't need you and your colleagues this year. But maybe we will. Maybe we will.
No,
Jeff,
hopefully not.
Jeff Wadsworth is a partner with Harder, Seacrest & Emery. Enjoyed it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate it.
You got it. A short break. More Connections coming up next.